Welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the law and politics podcast, with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen. In this episode, Ken and I want to focus on the Post Office Horizon scandal, now widely regarded as the biggest miscarriage of justice in British history. On four consecutive days from the beginning of this month, ITV broadcast its brilliant drama series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And to discuss some of the issues raised by this scandal, we are very lucky to have as our guest Patrick Green, King's Counsel. Patrick was called to the bar in 1990. He took Silk in 2012. Based in Henderson Chambers, he specialises in commercial law and civil fraud, together with a number of other areas. And in 2050, he was briefed by James Hartley at Freeth Solicitors to lead the counsel team, which acted for 555 sub-postmaster victims in a group civil claim. That claim culminated in December 2019 in a magisterial 313-page judgment handed down by Mr. Justice Fraser. It is a truly extraordinary judgment, which makes devastating findings of fact against the Post Office and the Horizon manufacturer Fujitsu. Our guest makes his first appearance at the start of episode 4. And he plays a significant role in the rest of the episode. As I say, we're very pleased to have him with us today. Patrick, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks.
Thanks very much for joining us, Patrick. We're delighted to have you.
So, Patrick, we'll obviously get stuck into the issues very soon, but tell us how you got into law. Why did you choose law? And when were you sure that's what you wanted to do?
Well, I wasn't really that sure at all. I hadn't necessarily worked as hard as I should have done at my A-levels. And I thought maybe doing a new subject where I had a clean sheet of paper would be quite fun at university. And I quite liked arguing and debating. So I thought I'd have a go at law. And then came to the bar, I think partly because every time I complained about something, my father used to say, well, life is unfair. And I never really thought that was a very acceptable explanation.
Well, you came across quite a lot of unfairness in this case, that's for sure.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking, even by the fairly elevated standards of some of my other cases.
So. Yeah. No, as I say, it is a truly shocking case. So we may have to be careful of the laws of libel in the way we discuss some of these issues, although frankly, having read Mr. Justice Fraser's judgment, I think we can speak fairly freely, can't we?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was in some ways it's sort of worse than everyone thinks because of all the small cruelties and things and the overwhelming sense of sort of despair for people who are locked into a position which would, you know, you simply couldn't escape from.
And of course, we'd always in the past regarded sub postmasters and sub postmistresses as the absolute pillars of local communities, particularly in sort of, you know, their own neighbourhoods. They weren't just shopkeepers; they were social workers, they were counsellors, they were advisors, and that comes across very powerfully in the programme. Could you tell us, Patrick, how you became involved in this litigation? When did they first approach you?
Well, they first approached Chambers in 2015. And I think because in my early years at the bar, by many conventional metrics, I'd been fantastically unsuccessful and done lots of pro bono work in my consequentially spare time. As soon as they said, you know, we've got these cases, some of which are many years longer, older than the six-year limitation period, some of the claimants have got convictions which you can't go behind. All the terms and conditions have been written so that only Post Office can win. And we've got no money and we need a Silk to work for free for a little bit and get us funding.
Yeah. Doesn't sound very promising.
Well, my senior clerk immediately said, that'll be our Mr. Green. So we had a meeting with James Hartley and Alan.
Yeah, well, in the drama series, we see James Hartley taking a phone call after he'd heard a Today programme item. So he then contacts Alan Bates, and then James gets in touch with you. I mean, we don't want to get too bogged down in the details of the way the litigation was funded, because some of our listeners understand about no win, no fee, and so on. But Just tell us briefly, if you can, how it was funded, because you had a bunch of civil litigants, as you say, with some of them with criminal convictions. They weren't eligible for legal aid. So the only way they were going to be able to get access to a court was via a no-win, no-fee arrangement. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it wasn't quite that. It was a litigation funder, Ethereum, who were absolutely fantastic. So we were all on partial conditional fee agreements where you take a reduced rate, and there was no way everyone could do that for 5 years against, you know, or more, which is what it threatened to be, against an opponent who had apparently unlimited money and resources when we didn't. So we needed litigation funding for two reasons. First, for that reason, to have, you know, be able to try and meet them, even though we only had one silk and four juniors for the whole trial. They used four different silks during the course of the proceedings.
All very expensive as well, I would imagine.
All very well regarded. But so one reason for getting the litigation funder in was to obviously be able to fund the actual legal work to win, because these people badly needed a win. And the other reason was that they were vulnerable, and if we lost, we could not have them all losing their homes. So someone had to purchase a massive insurance policy in seven figures to insure against the prospect of potentially losing, because it looked very, very different then to how it now looks. And someone had to pay for that, and no one had any money. So Ethereum came in as the funder, and they were fantastic.
I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It all looks now so obvious, as though, you know, you could hardly lose, you were bound to win, you know, the post office must have known from the start. But it wasn't like that, was it? I mean, some outlets like Private Eye, to their credit, huge credit, and Computer Weekly had been writing about this story for years, but it was a niche story. I mean, you must have, at the outset, facing these storied ranks of illustrious silks, the might of the post office, all of its funding, you must have been, I mean, was it intimidating? Was it scary to start with?
That's not something I often feel, but it was definitely, you felt anxiety for these people who really desperately needed help. And that was the stress. I think, you know, there was also this business of saying that, you know, basically my clients were completely irrational and, you know, ridiculous in complaining when thousands of other people had not complained. And we were, you know, variously described as, you know, troublemakers, etc. And my opponent also suggesting that one of the allegations that we'd put in the claim form didn't necessarily have a professionally proper basis for me to make it. So there was definitely quite a bit of heat.
We want to come on to how the post office conducted, how the post office legal team conducted themselves, and the recusal application that was made to try and get rid of the charges. But before we do that, there's one quite vivid scene in episode four of the drama series, in which you've just won the judgment from Mr. Justice Fraser in December 2019. You're back in your chambers, and everyone's there, and James announces to everyone that you've won, but the money's run out, and you've had to do a settlement. You've done a settlement, rather, and out of 58 million, they will only get 12 million divided by however many, and it's 20,000 each. And it's a sort of awkward scene, in a sense, because it communicates the anger of your clients at how much they end up with, a sense they haven't really won, and a sort of awkward thing of, well, you lawyers have got paid, and we're left with bugger all, virtually.
It is an interesting scene, because it almost casts the lawyers as part of the problem rather than the solution, as though this was in fact a defeat. Is that how it felt at the time?
Well, I've never had 41 hugs in open court from clients before. And that scene was a subject of some debate and discussion between me and Gwyneth. And, you know, she had to balance the narrative arc of the series.
Yeah.
And the need for a bit of a drop-off before the rallying with the factual background. And it's fair to say that we were all disappointed that we hadn't managed to get more money immediately into the pockets of our clients. But at the same time, there is a photograph of all these dissatisfied people cheering like mad outside court. And so that was... I understand. It's a docudrama. It's not a documentary.
I mean, Alan Bates, played by Toby Jones brilliantly, he does then correct everyone by saying, hang on, we always said you may get nothing out of this, but this was about getting access to the truth. It was about getting access to what the hell the post office had been up to and Fujitsu had been up to for years.
The problem in a case like that is somebody has to see the wood for the trees and work out what has to happen and go after it and make it happen. And these people needed a victory and they needed to be vindicated. And the truth, what Alan Bates repeatedly referred to as post office's wall of lies, needed to come down. And what doesn't come across in the show is that we also included in the settlement the cancellation of all the judgments, the discharging of bankrupts, that post office obtained against the clients. And we also included the setting up of the historic shortfall scheme for everyone who didn't participate to get 100%, which of course would then, of their compensation, which would then demonstrate the unfairness to those who did the work. And hopefully, and it was a bit of a Hail Mary, but it's worked, hopefully end up with the government topping that back up again. And we also included a requirement for post office to go through every single one of the convictions. So we did a settlement that reflected the reason why the case was brought. We were always intending to do a settlement. So that's, you know, the docudrama's a little bit incomplete in that respect. But, you know, Gwyneth did a brilliant job in condensing it as much as she did in the way that she had to.
But I'd agree. But I mean, too much detail there for a docudrama, but it was a stunning victory. And what you did was you absolutely set the scene for everything else that followed. I think after your victory, it was inevitable that the House of Cards was going to come down. But without your victory, it wouldn't have done. So a huge, huge success. Could we talk a little bit about the proceedings, because some of us looking as more or less interested spectators were surprised by some of the tactics employed by the post office. I'm not talking about the recusal application yet. We'll deal with that as a separate issue, because I think that's particularly interesting.
We were surprised too.
And I must say, having seen a photograph of Mr. Justice Fraser, I think anyone making a recusal application against him is a brave person. He looks like a sort of martial arts instructor. But let's put that to one side for the moment. What about their broader tactics? I mean, what did you make of them?
Well, I think they were, in some material respects, less than forthcoming.
That's very diplomatic, Patrick.
I'll give you one example. We discovered a reference to a document known as the known error log. And we thought that could be relevant to whether there were any known errors.
Because the clue is in the name. The clue is in the name, Robert.
Surely not. Yeah. Surely not.
So we rather unreasonably drew that inference and asked for a copy of it and actually pleaded it in our particular claim. And their defense said, the known error log, if it exists, doesn't contain, you know, the relevant information. Now, that turned out not to be correct. So, you know, even...
That's very disappointing, isn't it? It's very disappointing.
Yeah, yeah.
To put it mildly.
I mean, there's a very... another vivid moment is Alan Bates and Joe Hamilton are sitting in the pub and they're reflecting on what's gone on. And she says, are they incompetent or just evil? And I have to say that the way the drama depicts it, the behavior of the post office and Fujitsu over all those years, I mean, it communicates a sense of clear criminal misconduct. It's not just incompetence.
Well, there are definitely things which seemed to us at the time and seem now even more to have been very difficult to justify. I mean, Paula Venables' famous email that I was very keen on and Gwyneth included in the docudrama, where she's preparing to go to the Select Committee, and she says, remote access, you know, can we do it? what's the true answer? I need to be able to say that we can't, and then move on to our narrative boxes. I mean, that didn't strike us as an honest way to prepare to give evidence to the Select Committee.
It's the sort of piece of evidence that in a criminal pretrial application for the case to be dismissed for abusive process would be pure gold, because no judge, no criminal judge reading that could do anything other than draw the most adverse inference against her and the entire attitude of the post office. But it seemed to me that this is what came through time and time again in the proceedings. It was they wouldn't give an inch. They wouldn't concede where they should concede. They just fought every single ditch, which with far more resources than you. And in the end, of course, it culminated in this extraordinary application to Mr. Justice Fraser that he should recuse himself because he was biased, which had the predictable effect, I may say. but what did you, I mean, when they first told you they were going to make that application, how did you respond?
Well, that's one of the points. They didn't actually.
They waited and waited, didn't they? They delayed.
We were in, so the judgment from the common issues, because we had these two big 6-week trials, effectively back to back. So our opponent in the second trial was preparing for the second trial while we were doing the first trial. We came out of the back of the second trial and had to then immediately go into, out of the first trial, immediately go into the second trial. And the judgment landed at the beginning for the first trial, landed at the beginning of the second trial, because Mr. Justice Fraser only had a couple of months to write the common issues judgment, which is also a massive and pretty magisterial judgment on all the contractual points and, you know, good faith, unfair contract terms, non-incorporation and so forth. And Post Office then called their own evidence during the Horizon trial and led evidence. And then during that evidence, decided to make an application to recuse the judge. We got an email just before the typist's break, the transcriber's break, mid-morning, telling us what had happened. We couldn't believe it. And then they didn't tell the judge what was happening, and he just found a bundle with a recusal application on his desk in his room at lunchtime without being told it was coming.
Unbelievable. Just for listeners who aren't aware, a litigant can raise a question of recusal or standing down against a judge, and it can be based on an allegation of apparent bias or actual bias. And here, as I understand it, the allegation was actual bias.
It was really apparent. I think the focus was very heavily on apparent bias, because they did, you know, there's no real difference. You don't need to allege actual. But they did say that he'd made unwarranted criticisms of the post office. He'd made findings that were relevant to trial two in trial one, etc. And therefore, the objective observer would say that he couldn't come to trial two in an independent way.
I mean, these applications are extremely unusual, and it's the norm that when they're made, there is some strong basis for them, because it's such a serious thing to accuse a judge of being either actually or apparently biased in proceedings. You don't make an application like this lightly. But he wasn't impressed by it, was he?
Well, he wasn't impressed by it. I mean, we because the stakes were so high for us, because we simply couldn't have afforded to start again.
Yeah, but that's not something they'd have been unaware of. I mean, I don't say this about counsel, but there must have been people in the post office at the time that application was made who knew that Horizon had these problems, who knew that there had been disclosure issues with the defendants not being told about this. There must have been people in the post office who were aware of that when they were instructing counsel to make an application to recuse this judge for bias. And that is a scandal all of its own, isn't it?
It does come over very, very badly, particularly now that we know about the Clark advice, which was the advice by the barrister who was working in a firm of solicitors and said, you know, here are all these prosecutions where you haven't disclosed that there were bugs. You should do so. And Post Office's reaction, as I understand it, was to start shredding documents.
What, can you throw some light on this, Patrick? Because one of the findings Mr. Justice Fraser made and was the basis for the CCRC's reference to the Court of Appeal was that the post office had failed to disclose the full and accurate position regarding the reliability of Horizon. So in other words, they had the evidence, they knew, and it, not just one person or two people, but multiple people in different departments within the post office and Fujitsu, they all knew that this software was not robust as alleged by the post office. That was their fundamental defense. They knew the opposite was true. Now, the only way in which that type of suppression of non-disclosure can take place, it seems to me, is through a coordinated effort, because the danger is always that someone, if they're not in on the agreement to suppress, is going to do the decent, honest thing, as you'd expect, which is when you're being prosecuting people on the one hand or defending yourself in civil litigation, you disclose the most relevant material.
To be clear, what Tim is describing here is a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the way the attitudes sort of found expression in within post office internally, and I'm trying to be as fair as possible, is that they all were obsessed with this idea of protecting the brand, something that the judge asked them about. And that also meant defending the integrity of Horizon and, you know, not telling people. I mean, there was one clear minute where they're discussing one of the bugs. I think it may have been the Dalmellington bug. I can't remember which one it was. But there's a landscape document where they show, you know, the effect in different branches. A few of them are up, quite a lot of them are down. And then they go option one, option two, option three, and they're debating the merits of making corrections secretly that might call into question the integrity of Horizon, or actually owning up that there'd been errors and telling people. And that had downsides too. And you can see the concern is not to undermine the reputation of Horizon as being perfectly accurate all the time, and that being given an extraordinary amount of weight when you might have thought being candid and honest that something had gone wrong should be given rather greater weight.
But it's one thing to want to believe that your technology is up to scratch. It's quite another thing to know absolutely that it isn't robust, that it's littered with errors, and not to disclose it. I mean, I know there is...
No, that's terrible. That is absolutely terrible. And I mean, one of the bizarre things about it was there. Obviously, there were the bugs that we managed to identify and disclosure so far as we could. But even when it was working as designed, for example, if a postmistress orders 10,000 euros... and it arrives in a pouch, which she tries to scan and the scanner doesn't work, the deal is you enter it in manually. So when she types in 10,000 and presses the 0.00 button, which is what you press to do £5, £2, £3, you're doing that thousands of times a day. When she enters in 10,000.00, what do you think Horizon, working correctly, would record in her accounts?
100,000.
1 million euros.
1 million.
So that postmistress would immediately be 990,000 in debt, because there wouldn't be 1 million euros in the tray. There'd only be 10,000. And post office said, well, that is how it was designed, but that tended to be quite easy to spot. So that's working well, just to give you a frame of reference for what was going on.
I'm sure you're right in your analysis. I mean, it seems to me that Horizon was too big to fail. They just weren't able to admit that they might have got this wrong and that Fujitsu might have delivered a crap product. Shall we come on briefly to the criminal appeals, the judgment of Lord Justice Holroyd given in April of 2021? The appeal court judges in the criminal appeals, Josephine Hamilton and others against the post office, relied very heavily on Mr. Justice Fraser's judgment and were obviously profoundly impressed by it and agreed with every word of it. And they identified those factors that made cases a true Horizon case and it essentially found on two grounds of abuse of process that these convictions were unsafe and have to be overturned, and really said that looking forward, any cases coming before their court which relied substantially upon Horizon for the convictions would see those convictions overturned. So again, this was a great triumph, but the basis for the triumph, and one of the most moving parts of the drama documentary, Josephine Hamilton's acquittal in the Court of Appeal, but again, very much based on the work that you did. It must have been profoundly satisfying for you to read. Mr. Justice Holroyd, Lord Justice Holroyd, has become a really stellar criminal appeal judge over recent years, and this judgment is no disappointment. You must have been quite moved to read it.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It's hard when you know, we tried to tee everything up for everybody on all fronts. So we tried to gather what we referred to as nuts and berries as we went along in evidence, you know, not just going to get a mammoth and bring it back to roast on the fire, but getting nuts and berries that might be useful nourishment for other purposes. So we tried to get as many findings about the processes as we could properly before the court so that the judgments would be as useful as possible, because we knew the CCRC were looking at it and we were trying our hardest to get vindication, you know, across the piece for everyone on every front. But I have to say that, you know, Paul Marshall and Flora Page deserve a lot of credit for going after the second ground, namely that the convictions were not just unsafe, but an affront to the public conscience or the court's conscience, because that really was what happened. And it's very difficult when you've done your bit and you think you've done everything you can and you hand over to other people. You don't want to be ringing people up and bossing them around about what points they do take or don't take. So we stayed well out of it, but we were very pleased.
And the post office strongly resisted that ground, didn't they?
They did. And so absolutely, you know, not only were they acquitted, but on the proper basis. It was a very moving, very moving moment, because dear Joe Hamilton had been in court every day.
Yeah, she was amazing. Yeah. I mean, we criminal lawyers, all of us know that to win an appeal based on what's called limb two abuse of process, in other words, that the prosecution, however evidentially strong it may be, it is nonetheless an affront to the conscience because of the way the prosecution was handled.
Very difficult to win on that basis, yeah.
You hardly ever win. And here, Lord Justice Holroyd, in an earlier judgment, said, no, we are going to look at that ground, even if we're going to quash it anyway on ground one, we are also going to look at ground two, because it's in the public interest that this issue is exposed. And that leads directly, and Ken is, obviously, his previous experience as DPP is highly relevant here. The thing that comes out to me is here you've got a private body, the Post Office, taking sole responsibility for prosecutions, in almost every single one of them were private prosecutions by the Post Office, using their own internal investigators. They've got a vested interest in getting convictions based on the fact that the Horizon system isn't the cause of the problem. They control the disclosure process, and you end up in this outrageous, scandalous miscarriage of justice. I mean, do you agree that the idea that this was allowed to take place, private prosecutions could take place in this way, it has to be revisited?
Oh, completely. I mean, what was a concern to us, and this was just more of a feeling than anything else, but you saw quite a big pattern across the piece, which was that people who were just supplicants and said, look, I'm really sorry, I can't afford this, etc., tended to be treated much more gently than people said this must be the Horizon software. So much so that when proposing a less vicious approach to someone, there was an internal email saying, well, they haven't challenged the integrity of the Horizon software. So that was one facet of it. And the people who were prosecuted, it did feel as if by obtaining confiscation orders on the back of prosecutions and convictions, they were sidestepping the civil proceedings they would otherwise have had to have taken. And the point about that is that, you know, if you're sued for your 8 grand and you fight it in a civil court, okay, you might go down for some costs as well. Poor old Lee Castleton in the High Court went down for huge costs. But if everyone had been fighting...
321,000.
Yeah. But if everyone had been fighting these small cases when they first arose, post office would have been required to give proper disclosure. And they might have had a lot more difficulty strong-arming people into giving up. Whereas if you take someone to court and say, we're charging you with theft and you may go to prison for a very long time, they're absolutely terrified. And at the 11th hour, you say, oh, well, we'll get rid of the theft charge if you plead guilty to false accounting. And unwillingly, but inexorably, people accepted things they should never have accepted.
Well, I think there are two lessons here. One, of course, we've got to stop organisations like the post office. It is not just the post office. All corporations, places with corporate cultures, claims of loyalty and all the rest of it, from bringing cases in criminal courts. I mean, the whole point about prosecutors is they have to be objective, disinterested, open to self-doubt. And here you have a prosecutor with skin in the game, a lot of skin in the game, and this is the result. That's the first lesson. The second lesson, I think you've just touched upon, Patrick, and I think it's extremely important, and this is a moment for real introspection amongst lawyers and judges, how it is and how easily you can bully people into admitting to criminal offences that they haven't committed. And this is what happens in the United States all the time. Prosecutors overcharge in order to threaten people into pleading guilty on pain of otherwise going to prison. And that's what happened here, and it's an infection which we've got to prevent from coming over the Atlantic. It was absolutely appalling the way they threatened these people with prison unless they pleaded guilty. And what's the result? Of course, you know, people out there think, oh, well, no one ever admits to something they haven't done. Why would you do that? Well, here we see why people do it. It's through fear.
And if particularly in the case of Joe Hamilton, where there was an internal note of one of the investigators saying there was no evidence of theft.
Unbelievable.
That didn't stop them charging her with theft and then, you know, finessing it at the end.
Can we finish, Ashok? It's a question I want to put to Ken based on the article that he wrote in the Times a few days ago.
Sunday Times,
yeah. Because the government's proposal now is to enact legislation to just all convictions, all 700-odd convictions, to be quashed in one go as a matter of law because Parliament enacts it so. And you, Ken, have written questioning whether that is an acceptable way of proceeding. Plainly, the Court of Appeal Criminal Division has to look at each case individually, and it has to consider, as it did in Lord Justice Holroyd's judgment, it considered whether the convictions were indeed based on horizon, and where they were quashed, but some of them were not quashed.
I mean, this is really a question about who decides questions of guilt or innocence, the courts or Parliament. So it's really a separation of powers question. I think that Lord Justice Holroyd gave us a roadmap in his judgment for the way that these cases could be decided. I mean, he was looking at a batch of 42 cases. The Court of Appeal has made it clear that if cases are largely or primarily based on horizon, those convictions will be overturned. And it would be perfectly possible, it seems to me, to bring cases in that category before the Court of Appeal in batches. They could bring back, if they've got personnel issues, capacity issues, they could bring back some recently retired senior High Court judges to try these cases. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be possible to do that. The government is talking about bringing this legislation to give Parliament the power to determine the question of guilt or innocence. They're talking about bringing it forward within a few weeks. They're talking about it being on the statute book by the end of the year. So we're looking at 11, 12 months with Parliament approaching this question. I would have thought the Court of Appeal could deal with batches of these cases within that time frame. And I rather fear that what we're seeing here is a grand political gesture with the government responding to public outrage. And it's actually very unwise. It's a very slippery slope. I mean, who's to say that in future strikers won't have their, with a sympathetic government, have convictions overturned, or with a government of another stripe, polluters having their convictions overturned? I don't think we want these matters decided in Parliament. I think we should keep these as questions for the courts. But Patrick, I don't know what you feel about that.
Well, I mean, my instinctive reaction of being a bit careful about the separation of powers, I think I start from the same position that you do, Ken. and I agree it is a sensitive issue. I mean, possibly slightly to my surprise, came down slightly on the other side of the fence on this one, partly because it is so exceptional and partly for some other reasons that are more principled and objective. And I think, I mean, where I'd agree with you is if it can be achieved speedily through the courts, then that's clearly the best route. And I think we completely agree about that. I mean, it's not wholly without precedent because obviously the 2017 Policing and Policing and Crime Act dealt with pardons for offences of homosexuality of the deceased and for those who'd applied to have them disregarded, which did have some Home Office scrutiny. So it's not completely unprecedented, although that is slightly different. But the two other factors which weigh pretty heavily with me are beyond the massive delay, which I think is and the sheer numbers of people, is first of all that actually this is not Parliament overruling what the courts have said. This is Parliament implementing what Lord Justice Holroyd has said in his excellent Court of Appeal judgment. And I feel constitutionally there's a distinction between Parliament going with the grain of what the courts have said.
It's a good point. Good point.
And going against it. And I think that's a principal distinction. And the minor footnote to that is, you know, that's parliamentary action appears a bit more appropriate where what has been done, albeit by a private company that is in fact an emanation of the state. And that was done by the state, and in a way it feels that it's for the state to put it right. And once you've made a finding on ground two, not just ground one, in all those circumstances, that seems to me to be not a matter of reversing decisions that were properly made at the time, but acknowledging an affront to the public conscience that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, well, I think those are sophisticated and very good arguments, and I can see the force of them. I think I would maintain my position. The thing that really troubled me about my argument was that I think there are lots and lots of sub postmasters and sub postmistresses who haven't come forward.
Yes,
will not appeal their cases even if they're given the opportunity to do so. Some of them because they're guilty, and the Court of Appeal did find some guilty people when it was looking at these cases. But some because they're just so disillusioned and fed up with the whole system that they won't come forward, and so their convictions will stay, although they were unjust. And I think that's one of the advantages of the parliamentary route.
Yes, I think that's really important. We saw that in the number of people who didn't come forward for the group action.
Sure. Well, look, I agree with you. I'm going to give judgment for Patrick on this issue.
That's disappointing.
There you go.
I'm going to apply for you to recuse yourself for obvious bias.
It's only because Ken helped me at the end in reply.
Yeah. Very good. Well, listen, Patrick, it's been a fantastically interesting discussion. The drama series is brilliant, and congratulations for your role in this whole thing. Having had some involvement myself in being a legal advisor on TV and film projects, I know how often the truth can get changed. But from what you've said, this was an extremely accurate depiction of events. The only thing I would suggest is not accurate is that when we first see you, your desk is covered in briefs with pink ribbons. And I just wonder when the last time you had a brief with a pink ribbon.
Not for a while.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Right. Well, listen, thank you so much, Patrick. And as I say, many congratulations.
This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. I think it's rather a shame we don't have pink ribbons anymore, but there we are. Thank you very much, Patrick. And as Tim says, many congratulations.
Thank you, Ken.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Tim Owen and me, Ken McDonald. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation. We certainly have enjoyed it very much indeed. Real pleasure to have Patrick with us. Do subscribe to the podcast. Check out our back catalogue, which has many, many interesting episodes. We're now approaching our 50th anniversary. I think we're pretty close to 50 episodes, and you'll find plenty to interest you. Share the podcast, tell your friends, leave us a review, and we look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Our editor is Billy Lawrence. Our social media advisor is Jess Jones. See you soon.